Hottinger's hair.
This did not happen to any athlete. Andre is unconscious. He's being held up literally by Patera. And Stud continues to rape. Stud and Patera rape the dignity of Andre the Giant.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 91 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today, this is a very special episode, not because it's anything, you know, out of the ordinary. It's because as I am recording this intro right now, there is a power outage in my area, so I'm doing it entirely by candlelight. Usually, I will light a candle as I record, because I think the aroma helps me think or something like that. I don't know. I just like having candles around. And I'm drinking an iced coffee because the coffee maker didn't go on in the morning. So here I am, and I'll be covering the World Wrestling Federation on TBS. As if things aren't weird enough, we have the WWF on TBS from January 5th, 1985, which was a situation that started on Black Saturday, July 14th, 1984. And that's something when you talk about the WWF on TBS, that's the first thing that people are going to look at. It's a little bit of a cliche. Everybody knows that that show really sort of sucked in the backlash that, you know, that happened as a result of it. But there are actually, the idea that I have for Greetings from Allentown at some point in the future is to cover other shows from other territories that also took place on that day, because it's such a monumental day in pro wrestling history. There are shows from Memphis, Florida. I think there's an episode of Maple Leaf out there, which would also, of course, be WWF, as well as Championship Wrestling from Allentown. AWA, even Southeastern Wrestling has an episode out on YouTube somewhere from that exact date. One different comment that I could have about Black Saturday and how that all went down on TBS is just to cut a wrap in the style of PN News from 1991. It'll go something like this. On July 14th, see the Vinnie Mac crew. It's some crappy taped matches for you to view. Word up, Tony Garea is taking on Steel. People gonna change the channel, you know that's the deal. See, that's not too bad. Now that I got my singing out of the way, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. And you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on that and all the great shows you can find on this network and at ProWrestlingOnly.com a little bit later on. Just a reminder that we have a podcast. I have a podcast out with my partner Steve Bennett, the Adams Division podcast, looking at Survivor Series 87 through 98, ranking them 1 through 12 in the spirit of how we did a WrestleMania podcast and a SummerSlam 1 earlier this year. I do have a confession to make, and this goes back to, you know, something that I did this past weekend. I went out to the Kowloon, New England's premier Asian fine dining experience out in Saugus, Massachusetts, with a bunch of my old friends from high school, as we get together there maybe twice, maybe three times a year, just to have a bunch of Chinese food and to shoot the breeze. My persona on this podcast is a bit of a wiseacre, as you've probably figured out, but in real life, I tend to be a lot more body, and I'm not talking Jesse Ventura, I'm talking B-A-W-D-Y, because I try to run a clean show here. So there are certain things that I say at that table at the Kowloon, busting balls of other people, including people who aren't there, because we were talking about one guy. Just give an example here. And he had lost way too much weight and was looking rather frail. And I recalled once telling him how, dude, you look like Tom Hanks at the end of the movie Philadelphia. You know, I'm willing to speak truths like that to them. And then later in the evening, one of my friends who was at the dinner, he's actually a dean at one of the local colleges in Boston, in one of the schools. I forget exactly which one, and probably should withhold that to protect his identity. And he said, yeah, sometimes it's a real challenge in managing people, managing personnel and the professors and all that. So I gave him some worthwhile. I mean, I've managed people. Now, I haven't necessarily done it this way, but you gotta lay down the law sometimes. So As always, I look to the movies for advice on this. And I said, what you need to do is kind of act like Robert Davi in Showgirls. You know, go up to them and say, I'm getting really tired of your shit. First you get used to the money, then you swallow.
And you, where the fuck were you last night?
I was having my period, Al. You don't want me to get blood all over the place. Do you?
You're getting real tired of your shit, kid. Mm-hmm. If you want to last longer than a week, you give me a blowjob. First I get you used to the money, then I make you swallow.
Of course, I realized afterwards that in this era of Me Too, that's probably something that's not going to fly. And then I felt like I was going to go home and watch Showgirls at 2 in the morning. But luckily, instead, I just went immediately to bed. Also, kind of a weird work week for me as well, as on Monday, the guy who used to have my desk, who left the company, actually came back. He had got a job in Boston and hated the commute, so he actually returned to this job. And he was kind of looking at me like, oh, why can't I get my own phone number back? I had it memorized and everything. And I'm thinking, all right, well, first of all, you left. And then I started thinking, I should go up to him and just recite the entire Arn Anderson My Spot speech to him and then just walk away, like give him no context and see if he actually, I'm not offering you a spot, okay? Not your dog spot, not a liver spot, my spot. And you can have my phone number back with the 4307 extension or whatever it is. I don't even know what the phone number is. So kind of awkward, but you know, we'll see how that goes going forward. The guy also shares the name of a rather famous movie star. The only hint that I'll give is that this particular movie star is one of the outsiders. Hint, it's not C. Thomas Howell. So anyway, back to wrestling. This time slot on the Saturday night did not go well for the WWF through 1984, as the people in the South revolted almost immediately, deluging TBS with phone calls. So the very next week, you have Ole Anderson, the one owner of Georgia Championship Wrestling, who was pretty much aced out when Vince, in what I consider to be kind of a brilliant maneuver, it's nice to call it a maneuver because that would be a very Vince term. Vince went to the other owners of Georgia Championship Wrestling, Paul Jones, famously the Briscoes, and brokered a deal that way to get control of the time slot because Ted Turner would not sell him a time slot on TBS, and hence that rivalry got started. So you go through the fall, they're just showing the taped matches, as I alluded to in my rap, and it's also how they're still doing it in January of 85. Eventually, though, Ole Anderson forms Championship Wrestling from Georgia, which gets thrown on the air on July 20th, 84, so a very haphazard makeshift promotion, just get it on the air. Eventually, you know, becomes part of the NWA. It basically was, you know, recognized as the successor promotion to Georgia Championship Wrestling that Vince McMahon had just kind of folded into his own promotion. It had kind of ceased to exist, and they had a working agreement with Jim Crockett Promotions as well, and eventually Crockett would buy the time slot at the end of March of 1985, and that whole story of, well, this helped fund WrestleMania. But that was such a hilarious Crockett transaction, where he paid $1 million for a time slot that he was probably going to get anyway, because Turner was getting real sick of the WWF shit. It was going to throw him off the air. So Ted Turner taking a page out of the Robert Davi book from Showgirls. However, it never came to be, because the time slot was sold before it happened. It reminds me very much of how Crockett buys the UWF in 1987 when the UWF is in financial trouble. Anyway, spending something on a distressed asset that he could have gotten for nothing or for way less than what he ended up paying. It was just totally typical and par for the course. There is also one of the great what-ifs in wrestling history is Mid-South had their own time slot on TBS around this time. So in March of 85, you had Championship Wrestling from Georgia, the WWF, and Mid-South all airing on TBS in various time slots. And Mid-South Wrestling, of course, I loved it through 1984. It dipped a little bit in 85, but it's still a great what-if. Mid-South stays on TBS. If they get a regular weekly time slot, how does everything go there? Do they still run into the same money problems going forward? I think that things probably turn out the same, but I think it gets maybe deferred a little bit. But I think that they would have had a stronger 1985 had they ended up on TBS. Also, shortly after this show would have aired, the WWF actually moved matches to the studio in Atlanta, which was apparently part of the agreement for the time slot. Georgia Championship Wrestling had always taped matches in the Techwood studio, the TBS studio, and the WWF, they would just, you know, send in matches that had aired on their other programming in the weeks before. So this led to the absolutely surreal, I consider it more surreal than Vince McMahon showing up in front of the World Championship Wrestling logo on Black Saturday, Gorilla Monsoon calling matches from Techwood Studio, and stuff involving like Mr. Wrestling 2. Like, you don't know entirely what you're watching. It's certainly a lot to digest. So this is a huge misfire on the part of Vinnie Mac. And just kind of looking back on it, it was his failure to understand certain how ingrained wrestling was in the culture of the South and how it was presented to them, that to come in, especially from the North, because you have the whole North-South thing as well, and present completely different kind of wrestling without Gordon Solie, who was either fired or walked out. I mean, it doesn't really matter. All you know is that he's not there. Freddie Miller is still there. I'll more on him in a little bit. It's just presenting a completely different style of wrestling that was rejected out of hand by the fans of Georgia wrestling and, you know, all the other southern territories where TBS would have reached and people could have watched it on television. So a misstep for Vin, I have to say. But he did get a break because of Crockett buying the time slot out from under him, because it's something that he could have lost for nothing and ended up getting some money out of the deal. Because WWF in late 1984 was starting to run into some cash issues. They were losing television spots in some areas of the country because they were paying for time. And eventually, you know, they were falling behind on payments and they would actually get thrown off the air. So this narrative that you see sometime where Hogan comes in 84 and it's just this steady rise all the way to WrestleMania in 85 and then it was off to the races, you really have to drill down and examine it. And that's why it's one of the more fascinating periods to me to look at, because there were certainly bumps in the road, like this whole TBS experiment. However, they did try to put a better foot forward on this show because we have actual stars. However, these are all matches you could have seen on other shows, although some of them actually did not air until the January 5th episode of All Star or Championship Wrestling, which should be this exact same day. But we will see the WWF World Heavyweight Champion Hulk Hogan in action in a rare enhancement match for him after he would have won the world title. Tito Santana, number one contender to the Intercontinental title, in his feud with Greg Valentine, the IC champion. Those two guys are each in action today. We're going to see the Moondogs, and also Nikolai Volkoff is kicking off the program. But that's not the big angle that we're going to see on this show. As always, I like to pick shows where stuff happens. And one angle from the WWF from late 1984... Now, granted, we're in January of 85 here, is the Andre the Giant haircut angle, which is re-aired on this program. And it airs on a couple of different shows. It's on TNT. It's obviously on Championship Wrestling, which is an episode that I have in the Strategic Reserve. But I wanted to do this episode because I'd never covered the WWF on TBS previously. So I like to cover as many shows. This is why you see me covering WWF Action Zone or WWF Mania or stuff like that. By the way, I do have an episode on Mania coming up again soon. The Andre haircut angle is something that hit me like a ton of bricks when I saw it on Coliseum Home Video when I was about 8 or 9 years old for the first time. It really sort of blew me away. I know it's two haircut angles in back-to-back weeks, Lawler last week and Andre this week, but it is certainly one of the most memorable things. Like, seeing it for the first time as a kid, I remember exactly how I felt. And there are certainly biblical implications to this entire angle as well, which I will get into when we get to that match. So without any further ado, being that this is episode number 91, let's kick the show off with a look at a great sports moment from 1991.
1 minute, 5 seconds separate the Colorado Buffaloes from their national championship dream. And the Irish with the Rocket, Ismail, standing back waiting for the punt. With no timeouts for Lou Holtz, we'll have to go to the arm of Rick Meyer.
I'm sure Rowan will kick out of bounds. He'll punt out of bounds. He has to.
First priority is to get the kick away. The Irish will send 10 men. Off. Well done. The Rocket at the 10. And he's corralled for a moment. Breaks into the clear. One man to beat, and he won't get him. The Rocket, Ismail, has done it again. Touchdown, Notre Dame.
I see a flag, Dick. I see a flag.
There is a flag down at the Notre Dame 37, so hold on.
I know that most people, if they're looking for a football moment from January of 1991, they're going to go to Scott Norwood in the Super Bowl, missing that field goal wide right. But that guy's been kicked around enough. And also, if you examine that drive by the Bills, they should have pushed for more yardage because a 47-yarder on grass was certainly at the very, very outer limits of Scott Norwood's range. I think it gets remembered a different way because of kickers just becoming like supermen with long field goals in later years. But Rocket Ismail, who I had mentioned on a previous show and how he went to the CFL instead of getting drafted by the NFL later in 1991, I had to play his punt return that got called back against Colorado because it's such an unbelievable play. As it's the greatest kick return in history that didn't count because of how it got called back on a clipping penalty, which, by the way, there was a penalty on the play, but it's not as if where you can see a block in the back, but that's not the one that got called. It was a different call around, as they said, around like the 35-yard line or so, that you couldn't really see on camera. So in the context of the play, it didn't matter. So that's why I can sit back and admire Rocket Ismail in that punt return, because they're down 10-9, and it's no timeouts, and they were not a team that was used to passing the ball a lot, because Lou Holtz and that option offense with Rick Meyer, even though he went on to become a number two draft pick in the NFL, they still kind of ran their offense a certain way. It's just crazy to me how Colorado, one of the weakest national champions of all time, having lost a game and had a game end in a tie, and also winning another game because they were granted a fifth down because the officials screwed up, kicking the ball down the center of the field for Ismail to actually return it, kick the ball out of bounds, like Bill Walsh was saying. It's absolutely crazy. And you had a punter, Tom Ruin, who had like a 12-year career, I think, in the NFL, punting for the Broncos and a few other teams. It kind of just speaks to how I don't think Bill McCartney was a very good football coach. But hey, live and let die. So we got awkward Freddie Miller kicking off the show. He passed away in 1992. And like many broadcasters of wrestling from his era, he was actually a newsman at station WXIA, which is now NBC 11 in Atlanta. And he's famously there on Black Saturday to introduce the show before handing it over to Vince McMahon. So in a way, Freddie Miller is kind of the Marshall Henry Patain of pro wrestling history. He was the leader of Vichy France, the Nazi-occupied version of France when it was conquered in 1940, and Patain was kind of the leader of the puppet government. So I kind of see Freddie Miller a little bit. He's an amiable sort of guy, but he also is a little bit awkward in how he goes into the show.
A brand new year. This is World Championship Wrestling on TBS. And for the World West Wrestling Federation, hey, I haven't done this in a couple of weeks.
Geez, he couldn't have done a second take there? I mean, when I record this show, I often edit stuff as I go along. Not as much as I used to, but if I don't like the way the intro sounds, I'm going to redo it. Maybe not today, because my laptop sucks on power because I've had it for so long. And the fact that, you know, we got a power outage here. So I'm up against the clock. I'm going to have to stop recording and save the file as I go along.
But first, on behalf of all of us, we do hope you enjoyed the holidays. We'd just like to say thanks for all the nice comments. We've really gotten so many over the holidays since the Christmas show first appeared. Many of you from far away and for wherever you are, we appreciate your tuning in and also saying they were extra special for you.
I'm not sure what those comments are, because you only ever think of the backlash to the WWF programming, or what that Christmas show he's referring to. That's not something I've ever seen materialize. But he does throw it to the first match, which is Nikolai Volkoff taking on Bob Marcus. And you can tell from the ring announcer and the setup that this was an All-Star Wrestling taping. It actually aired on the December 29th edition, so a week before this, and it's... So it's in Ontario, because it was doubling as Maple Leaf Wrestling at that time, as I covered back episode 54. And Nikolai is walking to the ring with his CCCCP, it's only three C's, Moscow Olympics red shirt that has the same font as the security guy who's walking next to him that has a shirt that says WWF Security. I found that kind of interesting, and then I remembered... Oh yeah, back in those days, you could get any sort of t-shirt at the mall, but it was only one kind of lettering. There was no Helvetica, there was no Arial, Times New Roman, you only got what they happened to have. So he's doing the national anthem bit, and I'm very anxious to see whether he uses the actual real words. And he does, but as a special treat, and this is not something you would get very often from Volkoff, he would actually sing the second verse on occasion, and this was one of those times.
Last waltz is for Nasze Slobod moje, Duzny na lodore, Duzny opo, Zemlja sowieskaje, Zemlja na lod moje,
Seeing as though this is a taping in Canada, I was hoping that they were going to shout the Canadian national anthem right back at him, as I covered in that Maple Leaf Wrestling episode. That is one of the great gems that I've uncovered on this show, is the crowd singing the Canadian national anthem over Volkoff doing the Russian national anthem. That was just so great. But I'm calling shenanigans on something the production team threw in, because they cut to a crowd shot, and in one of the crowd shots, somebody is holding up an American flag. And I think that that's interspersed from a different audience, because it kind of looked like a different arena on the on the brief cut, from at least what I could ascertain. But making up for that is the fact that classy Freddie Blassie, who is there, he wouldn't make all of the Canada tapings, but he is there this time, and he is so freaking hilarious just standing there during the anthem, like, showing pride. He was always very good at that. Now, as I continue to sit here in the dark recording this podcast, one thing, when I chose this one, obviously the Andre haircut angle is the hook, but there is one very, very pleasant surprise that makes me oh so very happy and makes me give thanks for everything in my life on this week of Thanksgiving here in the United States, because we're on the All-Star tapings. You're using the Maple Leaf Wrestling crew, so that means we still have Angelo Mosca on commentary.
One thing about the free enterprise system, we respect anybody and anywhere for what their national anthem stands for, so that's his prerogative.
I certainly admire Angelo Mosca speaking out for freedom of speech here in the world of pro wrestling. I mean, we're kind of on a war footing with the Soviet Union in the United States in 84, because things didn't really start to de-escalate until Gorbachev takes office, and that's not for another year. It was one of the Soviet guys that died who's there right now, maybe like Chernenko or whatever. It's later on in the year. There's actually a movie that's airing on TBS that we're going to see a commercial for later in the show, because a lot of the commercials were actually left on this show. So Volkov in 84, earlier on in the year, he's facing his future hero, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, in Mid-South Wrestling, having some good brawls there. But it was natural for him to come in to the WWF as a Hulk Hogan opponent, because Nikolai Volkov was still a very plausible main eventer at that time. And in fact, main evented the first Saturday Night's Main Event later in 1985 with Hogan in a flag match. And also, to have a second foreign heel to go alongside the Iron Sheik, who was your main bad guy, but it made sense to have a Soviet bad guy, because there really wasn't one of those in the WWF, since Ivan Koloff was sort of blacklisted after his little run in 1983. You just never saw or heard from him again. Mosca speaks up for Bob Marcus, saying he has a very good reputation, but for whatever reason, he's not sure about that tonight. I'm not entirely sure why he would say either he has a good reputation or he doesn't. But he gets dropped on the top rope in a clothesline fashion. And Marcus does fire up, but it's not quite enough. And Nikolai gets his finisher, which is the press slam into a backbreaker. You can say whatever you want about Volkov. Later on, he wasn't particularly mobile or dynamic in the ring. But I do like that press slam into the backbreaker, because it looks like a cool move, even though he's kind of grabbing the guy's tights and maybe giving him a wedgie at the same time. But hey, maybe that kind of, you know, enhances the move in a certain way. So an easy win for Nikolai Volkov from that episode of All-Star Wrestling, airing on WWF on TBS.
On tour with the World Wrestling Federation tonight, Baltimore, Maryland, the Baltimore Civic Center. Tomorrow night, Columbus, Ohio, the Ohio Center. Next Tuesday, the 8th, Altoona, Pennsylvania, Chapel Mosque. Be there!
I edited that sucker down because it went on for much longer, including Texas shows that were coming up, which I thought was a little strange, because I thought I had heard that TBS didn't go to Texas at that point in the 1980s, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, they're kind of going all over the place. But the Jaffa Mosque, as listeners of the Titans of Wrestling podcast of long ago would know, the Jaffa Mosque, the place where jobber dreams come true, because they often would have enhancement versus enhancement matches, so you would see stuff like Frankie Williams or something emerging victorious in that place. And then you get the catchphrase, Freddie Miller, be there, which, for whatever reason, Jack Edwards uses that for Bruins games on Twitter. I don't know if Jack Edwards is a fan of Freddie Miller, but whatever, it's probably just a coincidence. Go into the ad break, and then there's an ad for a thermos, which I thought was for the actual thermos itself, but it was actually for Trustworthy Hardware for which I thought was dead, and then when I looked it up, there's actually a location in Lynn, Massachusetts, as well as one in Laconia, New Hampshire, right near Lake Winnipesaukee. Also an ad for an upcoming movie airing on TBS, Walking Tall. Yes, the same movie that The Rock made in 2004, but this would be, of course, the 1973 version in which the main character is actually a former professional wrestler. So kind of funny that that was not something that was carried over to when Dwayne Johnson The Rock is doing a remake of the film 30 years later. And for those of you who follow the NBA, you'd remember that in the 80s, it aired on TBS. This was before TNT was actually launched. That would not come until, I think, 1989 is when TNT launched. I forget the exact date, but they have some upcoming games.
Chop and a three slam bang contest in America's game, the NBA. Sunday, Indiana invades the West, taking on the Portland Trail Blazers. Monday, Larry Bird and world champion Boston battle hotshot Bernard King in New York. And Thursday, it's a West Coast clash when Seattle wages war with Golden State.
That's quite a slate of games. So, of course, I took the liberty of looking up how those games finished and what may have happened in them. This is several years before Reggie Miller was with the Indiana Pacers. So that was a bad Pacer team. In fact, we're at the point in 85 where Cheryl Miller, much more famous basketball player than Reggie Miller was, who was in college at the time. I always like the line in Seinfeld where Elaine says, when they refer to Reggie Miller, like, oh, you mean Cheryl Miller's brother? I always kind of like that one. So in that Portland-Indiana game, Portland made the playoffs as a 42-40 team out in the West. Indiana was really bad, about 20 wins. Portland wins 118-101. The only thing, though, is looking at the box score of that game, you can tell how much basketball has changed since January of 1985, because in that entire game, only 3 three-point shots were attempted the entire game, and 0 of them were made. Can you imagine an NBA game now where no 3-point shots were made in the entire game? The game has evolved in such a way where they've seen the efficiency and value of 3-point shots, especially since everything has evolved with guys becoming better shooters from the outside, which kind of became a necessity with, you know, them allowing zone defense at a certain point. That Celtics-Knicks game was a 108-97 win for the Celtics, who were on their way to their second consecutive Eastern Conference title. Larry Bird, 26 points, 10 boards, 10 assists. Ho-hum, another triple-double for Larry Legend. And that Seattle-Golden State game was hysterical because these are two terrible teams that you'd never put on national television these days. Back then, it felt like they seemed to have this notion that, like, we got to put all 23 teams on television, and it doesn't matter when it is. Seattle ended up winning over Golden State 89-86. Jack Sikmo, 25 points. So out of these six teams here that are for these upcoming games, four of them would not make the playoffs in a league where only 7 teams out of 23 would end up missing the playoffs. And then finally, a spooky ad for what I had mentioned earlier, this movie called Threads that would be airing on TBS on January 13th. It's basically the British take on the movie The Day After, the sort of nuclear Holocaust movie. The Day After was set in the Kansas City, Lawrence, Kansas area in the United States. So this is kind of the British take on that.
For some reason, Blackjack Mulligan certainly does not agree with this man's way of life.
I heard him get out here and cuss the Iron Sheik and myself. We could care less what that grid eater talks about. And he's talking about gas. Texas has no gas.
Well, clearly Freddie hasn't had enough beans and Texas barbecue, because that'll certainly generate gas for you in a hurry. Either that, or he's kind of making a commentary on upcoming happenings in the oil market, because that would hurt the economy of Texas. And later in 85 and into 86, when oil prices would drop on world markets. But the Iron Sheik gets to speak his piece here, and I'm not entirely sure what this is.
You try to put the mustache to be the man like the Iron Sheik. I have a news for you. In the Persia, we have a Persian cat that have a mustache like you.
Oh, come on.
Doesn't Doesn't mean you are rugged. Doesn't mean you are the tough like the Iron Sheik. Your Texas oil doesn't impress me. Your horse doesn't impress me. I've been through all of them. I had all of them. Only thing I have, you don't have, I'm the wrestler.
That's right.
Cameraman, zoom the camera to that 52-inch chest. Mr. Jack Mulligan, big deal.
Look from, at the medal.
From Texas, foot all here. Mr. Jack Mulligan, after I checked you down, I kicked you just like I kicked
one.
The lazy
You're
camel.
I'm sorry, we are all out of time.
Not entirely sure what Sheiky Baby actually said there, but it seems to me that this feud is mostly about facial hair. So, I don't know, there's been sillier reasons for guys to go at it. But we actually see Black Jack Mulligan in our next match, except no counterfeits on this one. For his brief run in late 84 and into 1985, he is taking on Ted Grizzly, one of the great Canadian enhancement talents of the time, star maybe of a future Making a Murderer. I know I've made light of that in the past, but it just seems crazy to me that he was involved in a murder around 1973-74 and then later went on to become a mall Santa, which just says to me how the world used to be different back in the 80s, how we would let a former murderer actually serve as a mall Santa later on. That's the kind of stuff that wouldn't really fly today. But as for Black Jack Mulligan, who always seemed to be making brief stays in the WWF, although his one in 86 was longer, you just kind of don't think of it that way because he's there as Big Machine and not as Black Jack Mulligan, and then when he takes the mask off, when the Machine's thing runs its course, he's only there through the beginning of 87 to the point where he's not even there by the time WrestleMania 3 rolls around and his proposed feud with Outlaw Ron Bask ends up getting aborted. Here in late 84, also a very brief run before I believe he heads back to Florida. It always kind of makes me wonder why they kept taking him back when he would have these brief stays. He was in 82 against Backlund to kind of be the monster for a couple of months who was challenging him. But at this point, he is hosting a talk show segment on All-Star called Blackjack's Barbecue, which had kind of an outdoorsy-looking set. But the thing that I remember it most for is in the opening to Maple Leaf Wrestling, how he would do the do-si-do walking around dance with Junkyard Dog. And then they would do this awkward high-five thing. And then he would do like the Billy White... Blackjack Mulligan would do like the Billy White Shoes Johnson like knee shake thing at the end really quick. Always kind of a weird thing. But that segment did not last very long and then eventually would get replaced by the Superior Body Shop hosted by Jesse Ventura that would highlight All-Star Wrestling all through 1985. Some awkward tosses by Mulligan to start out. And he is in his, he's nearing his mid-40s at this point. So certainly on the back nine of his career here, I think he's just teed off on 16. And we, kind of an odd thing in this match, which is called by Jack Reynolds and God bless him, Angelo Mosca back again for this one, a near ref bump where just a regular Irish whip and the referee like has to really scurry to get out of the way. And Mulligan actually ends up scoring with a big boot. Here, though, earlier on I had mentioned how you accept no counterfeits when it comes to Blackjack Mulligan. But Mosca on commentary seems to be a little confused by this and actually refers to him by the wrong name.
I think Grizzly wanted to establish a reputation, and I think Blackjack Mulligan is establishing his own reputation to show him who's bossing here.
Don't be a sap, Dad. These are just crappy knockoffs.
I know a genuine Panaphonics when I see it. And look, there's Magnet Box and Zorny.
Mosca and Mulligan do have one thing in common outside of being challengers to Bob Backlund earlier in the 80s. It's that they both had a football background before getting into wrestling. Mosca, of course, one of the greatest players in the history of the Canadian Football League back in the 60s. It's a reference to Mulligan as having played for the New York Jets at one time, and I checked it out, and in fact, he did play for them when they were in the AFL back in 1966, but only in the preseason. So it's one of those things where you can say, well, you did play for them, but you got cut in training camp, kind of like how John Lynch played for the Patriots, but he was cut in the 2008 preseason. But that didn't stop me from buying a John Lynch Patriots jersey that was on sale for $3 at a Marshalls. It's one of my all-time favorite purchases ever. And now Lynch is the San Francisco 49ers general manager. I mean, you could really say that for all sorts of things. Like, I could say that my grandfather played for the 1936 Braves, when in reality, they kind of had an open tryout, and my grandfather went to it as a shortstop and obviously did not make the team. That was kind of coming out of the 1935 Braves being a complete disaster with 115 losses and having an open tryouts and eventually being renamed the Boston Bees in 1936. But the greatest story of Black Jack Mulligan in the WWF, or more accurately, the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, because this dates to very early in his career back in 1971, an incident that took place at the Boston Garden, because Mulligan is being built up as a initial challenger to Pedro Morales, because they had just worked the belt from Bruno through Ivan Koloff onto Pedro Morales, and Mulligan was one of the first challengers. And on May 15th, 1971, at the Boston Garden, he was stabbed in the thigh by a fan, and it required a couple of hundred stitches to close the wound. And as it turned out, the guy who stabbed him was corralled by Gorilla Monsoon, who then threw him over to the police, and then the Boston police ended up letting the guy go because they thought it was all part of the show. Just crazy wrestling stuff from the 70s. I'd love to, you know, hear more stories about that. And I know it does not reflect well upon my hometown, this having taken place in the Boston Garden, which it's always struck me that the Garden was a pretty crazy venue in the 70s for, you know, that, wrestling concerts, Bruins games. I'm going to blame it on the fact that the Bruins got upset in the playoffs in 71 by the Canadians, and people were still very angry about that. Mosca notes the speed and stamina on both these guys, which I cannot think of a match that reminds me more of speed and stamina than Ted Grizzly versus Black Jack Mulligan, other than maybe Dino Bravo versus 1988 Ken Patera. They're literally just walking around for much of this match. There's a few punches thrown in. I mean, there's not much in the way of dynamic offense, and Mulligan gets the win with the Irish whip into the back elbow. So no claw for him at this time, which, like, there was in 82 when they brought out the big red X to kind of really put it over as a killer hold. As I said, he comes back in 86 as Big Machine, and then eventually the mask comes off and he's himself for a very short period. But what I liked about him using the back elbow here is it allowed Nobel-winning physicist Angelo Mosca to explain Mosca's first law of physics regarding this back elbow finisher.
You take about three steps of 300 pounds, that's 900 pounds of force hitting a movable object. Anything can happen.
This is why I have to do every single show that Angelo Mosca ever did commentary on for little gems like that, because I seem to learn something every time. Another place I can learn a little bit is at ProWrestlingOnly.com, where you can explore other podcasts such as This Week in Wrestling, with two episodes this week. The second one just had to cover the NXT TakeOver from Survivor Series weekend in Los Angeles this past week, and also WorldCast doing a special episode on the life and career of Jose Lothario. So if you have this image of him as being the old guy trainer for Shawn Michaels from 1996, there is way more to Jose Lothario than that. If you listen to the Space City and NWA On Demand podcast on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in the past, you would already know that. But go to ProWrestlingOnly.com for those podcasts, other match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, and matches, or playlists, wrestler appearances on non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. You can join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of a lot of threads, an indeterminate number. Our message board is a vibrant community on its own. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope form, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present, check all of this out at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
It happened recently in a match when Andre the Giant was floored by Bobby the Brain Heenan and Big John Studd and Ken Patera. And while he was knocked out, they started cutting his hair. To say the Giant is furious is putting it mildly.
That's exactly where you want to say spoiler alert, Freddie. I know that wasn't en vogue at that time. I just picture Freddie hosting dinner in a movie on TBS about a decade after this and saying, coming up in Die Hard with a Vengeance, Hans Gruber's brother goes for revenge against John McClane. Like, yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Freddie. I really appreciate it. But this had already aired on Championship Wrestling back on December 1st, and it was taped November 13th. In Poughkeepsie, New York, at the Mid-Hudson Civic Center. So this is kind of old news. It's 7 weeks in the can, and had already been on most of the programming, like four or five weeks before this. So it's kind of symptomatic of the TBS issue that the WWF had, is it's rehashed stuff of things that the audience really didn't want, although a haircut angle much more common in Southern wrestling than it was in the WWF. I'm racking my brain trying to think of one prior to 1984, and I really can't think of them running such an angle prior to this Andre thing. So Vince Sr. crossed that off, and Vince Jr., as I've mentioned last week and before, didn't really get the whole concept of haircut angles, and then he would employ Brutus Beefcake, who would basically end up killing the haircut match with his gimmick. So as the match is set up with Patera and Big John Studd facing Andre and a mystery partner. And for whatever reason, and this is one of the things that people like to joke about, Andre picks SD Jones as his mystery partner. I don't know if this was one of those things like when a baseball team is in a series and their whole pitching staff is blown out. So like the 2004 Red Sox had to go to Derek Lowe on 2 days rest, I think it was, in Game 7 against the Yankees in 2004. I'm not comparing Derek Lowe to SD Jones by any means. I mean, SD kind of struggled in 84. Actually, Derek Lowe kind of struggled in 2004. So you're hoping to get something out of good old SD with his 54-103 record that year. Which, by the way, SD in December of 84, so after it was taped, before it was aired, was actually losing to Bobby Heenan on house shows, starting that noble tradition of persons of color losing to Bobby Heenan on house shows in presidential election years that would be continued by Coco Beware in 1988. Let's break kayfabe here for a second. Why would you pick SD Jones? Well, you got to sacrifice somebody for how you're having this angle to be pulled off. So who better than SD to kind of play this role to the hilt? It also kind of, with the way it turns out in Andre getting his hair cut, I think Andre might have, you know, harbored some resentment to SD Jones after this. You don't see them teaming up ever again. And perhaps Andre's issues with persons of color, with various racial remarks he might have made where he got punked by Bad News Brown on a bus or called out for it later on, maybe we can trace it back to this point, and Andre just developed kind of a racist worldview. But that might not be the case, because you fast forward to Saturday Night's Main Event in 85, and you got him teaming with Tony Atlas against Bundy and Studd, and then eventually it works its way to the Hogan-Andre super team taking on Bundy and Studd. So it's a whole little process here. And as we start the match, and I'm looking at these four guys, and I certainly respect Ken Patera for what he did earlier in the 1980s. He might be the best wrestler in the world for the year 1980. You can certainly make that case, particularly if you have a WWF-centric viewpoint. But honestly, the best worker in this tag match is Andre the Giant's trunks, because they are working their ass off, no pun intended, to try and cover up everything Andre's got, because he's ballooning, he's gaining a little bit of weight, and they are stretched to within an inch of their life. The technology required by these tights, this is NASA kind of stuff here. NASA needed to work on materials to cover up Andre, to get better fitting tights for him that were maybe a little bit more flattering, because he's got the gut hanging over it, you know, full banana hammock. Unfortunately, it's not something that they really got to in time. And then when the Challenger exploded in 86, you got, you know, the missions go away, and now Andre switches to the singlet with the one strap when he turns heel. So it's something I think the research might have gotten derailed on that. Now, before the match actually begins, I need to tell a story. There are certain biblical implications from this angle. It is a fairly well-known story from the Old Testament, the book of Judges, chapter 16, the story of Samson and Delilah. I would love to do the reading for this, but I'm a little bit leery of religion because sometimes it gets twisted for bad motives, although it also has helped a lot of people on the other side of things. But for me, being a Catholic from Boston, you know, with some of the scandals, which, by the way, Sinead O'Connor was totally right, because when she ripped up the picture of the Pope, it was to protest child sexual abuse, and it was before all that stuff ever broke. I just got to get that out there, that she got, like, literally the rawest deal in history with the way people remember her and they forget exactly why she did what she did. So, yeah, I would love to read this, but maybe I need a little bit better voice for that. So I turn now to the voice of Greetings from Allentown, Keith Langston, reading from the book of Judges, chapter 16.
Delilah said to Samson, "Until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me what you may be bound with." And he said to her, "If you weave the seven locks of my head into the web of the loom." So she wove it tightly and with the batten of the loom. And she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he awoke from his sleep and pulled out the batten and the web from the loom. Then she said to him, "How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these three times and have not told me where your great strength lies." And it came to pass, when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death, then he told her all his heart and said to her, "No razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." When Delilah saw that he told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me all his heart." So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hand. Then she lulled him to sleep on her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." So he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. The Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. However, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven.
Thank you, Keith. I think there's a lot to impart upon this match from that particular Bible verse. But I want to talk about the match itself first. Our referee is Alberto Roman, which make a note of that, because I'm going to have a little bit more to say about him a little bit later. We start with SD and Patera, arm dragged by Jones, and he tags out to Andre. And they're actually working on Patera's left arm. And I noticed that SD has the thing that I love with the striped socks that come up over the boot so that you can see a little bit of the sock. I always like that. SD giving me exactly what I want, but he gets caught and a backbreaker by Patera. You can see they cut to Hillbilly Jim harassing Bobby Heenan. And in late 84, in the fourth quarter of 1984, Hillbilly Jim is all over WWF programming, just showing him in the crowd mostly. But here he's yelling and heckling Bobby Heenan. Back elbow by Stud. And then Patera is in, but he puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for a ring veteran like him, especially a guy who was the consensus best worker in the world for 1980. SD tags Andre into the match, but before SD can get out of the ring, Patera kind of backdrops him in the way that you would see a lot of Royal Rumble eliminations. So he hits the floor. There's no padding out there. There's no blue mats at this point in time in late 84. And he slips, falls, and as the story goes, he hits his head on the guardrail at ringside. So now SD is out of it on the outside of the ring. And Andre marches in. Patera begs off into the corner. And Andre does that move where he has the guy trapped and he grabs the corner ropes and just kind of drives his back into Patera. But on the second attempt, Patera gets a knee up and Andre falls and Patera comes off the top rope with a forearm to the back of the neck. He tries to get a full Nelson on him for a second. And then I think he kind of realizes that he can't get his arms all the way around the giant. So Stud is in. There's no tag made. So Alberto Roman is just kind of letting it get out of hand. If we had Dusty Rhodes on commentary, he would be yelling, "Clubberin', there's a Clubberin' right there." But unfortunately, we have Vince and Bruno because this is pulled from the Championship Wrestling. This also aired on Maple Leaf Wrestling earlier than this. But the interesting thing about that was there was an extended sort of outro to it where they showed more of the aftermath of the haircut. But only on Maple Leaf Wrestling. It was kind of strange. Now, you've probably seen all of what happens here with a double body slam by Stud and Patera. So you cannot say, oh, this guy slammed Andre the Giant because it's both of them. And when in fact, you know, Andre had been slammed in the WWF numerous times before this, most of them by Hulk Hogan, but he'd also been slammed by Harley Race and others as well. Weirdly, Patera goes to the corner and then realizes he wouldn't be able to reach Andre from there, so he goes to the middle of the ring and gets on the second rope and does like one of the worst knees I've ever seen. Very awkward. And now Alberto Roman now sees fit to actually DQ the heels, and he is just awful here. If you watch Alberto Roman during this entire angle, and he gets grief for being one of the worst referees in the history of the WWF. And I've kind of defended him because usually I see him in these squash matches. You don't see him in a big spot because by the time they're doing pay-per-views, he's long gone. You don't really see him anywhere other than the TV tapings where there's not a whole lot for him to do. But he is so friggin' bad here because he's just completely ineffectual. He's just moving his arms in a pantomiming fashion. If you're going to do this angle, have the heels do something to the referee to incapacitate him. Throw him into the corner turnbuckle or something, into the padding, and just have him fall over and just lay there. He doesn't have to go over the top rope to the ring, you know, to ringside floor or anything like that. He doesn't have to take a hard bump, but the fact that he's just standing there watching this looks completely ludicrous. I mean, for whatever reason, I'm looking at Alberto Roman, and I'm thinking of Hervé Villaches of Fantasy Island. Tattoo. Tattoo would have been a better freaking referee in this spot than Alberto Roman. He would have added a lot more to the angle, although it would have been weird to be having a celebrity for this particular tag match. Patera and Stud, they drop about, like I lost count, like 12 consecutive elbows on Andre, because you really got to drive home the fact that they are just nailing his ass. And they turn him over and sort of hold him up. And this is where Heenan jumps up on the apron and produces a pair of scissors from his pants. Now, luckily, he had them stored properly. I'm very concerned, going back to Pez Watley, Dr. Tom Pritchard, all that, very concerned about scissor safety, because the stuff that guys are wearing, sometimes a lot of guys wearing tights, not really a good place to put scissors. You know, if you put it in your boot like Pritchard did, I think that's good. This is something that was widely seen on the Coliseum video. It was on the Andre the Giant tape, which seems a little strange considering that Andre gets humiliated in this match, gets his hair cut, and you're putting it on the Andre the Giant tape. Although it is a necessary thing to explain the Andre story. But also, it is one of the most famous Vince McMahon calls of all time. And hell, even Bruno pipes in with his one line.
What? Andre is out. What? Oh, no. Oh, this is humiliation. This is sheer humiliation.
I appreciate Vince's wordplay with the nice pun of sheer humiliation, and Bruno showing that he's never seen a proper haircut angle done before. They're cutting his hair? However, also Bruno not particularly familiar with haircuts since he had been going with the synthetic look since at least the mid-70s, because you'd see Bruno show up with all different kind of hair where you wonder, how did he grow like a full perm? Like that, like around 78. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense. So he was running on the, like a car that runs on synthetic motor oil instead of conventional. That's what, like, Bruno's hair was like.
Happens to any athlete. Andre is unconscious. He's being held up literally by Patera. And Stud continues to rape. Stud and Patera rape the dignity of Andre the Giant, who has been recognized as one of the greatest athletes of all time. And Heenan keeping SD away, and Stud and Ken Patera continue to rape Andre the Giant's dignity. Look what they're doing to this man.
I can't believe it. Nothing's happened to stop this. This is ridiculous. They won't stop. Look at this, both of them.
Oh, my. A nightmare. A complete nightmare.
My goodness.
This is one of the most despicable displays of conduct in the history of the World Wrestling Federation. In the history.
Certainly one of Vince McMahon's most memorable calls. The word rape might be a little strong for today's audience, but in 1984, he's trying to get the point across. It's strong enough then, but people aren't taking as much offense to it at that time. He's trying to drive home how heinous an act this is. In fact, Vince's call of this is so memorable that when they did a similar angle almost exactly 20 years later with the Big Show, you know, Andre's son, according to WCW lore, they had Michael Cole say the exact same thing.
Kurt Angle is raping Big Show of his dignity.
Not exactly the same gravitas with Cole on that call, but he approached it a little bit differently in that he remained more silent and let the crowd reaction to what Kurt Angle, Luther Reigns, and Mark Jindrak were doing to the Big Show. Luther Reigns and Mark Jindrak. I don't know what the hell is going on there, but it's September 2004 SmackDown. I really don't know much about that. So Stud and Patera, they like doling out the haircuts so much that on an episode of Tuesday Night Titans, they gave a very bad one where they did kind of a skit to a dude who looked like Kevin Dunn, but I don't think was Kevin Dunn. It just kind of looked like him, and then it was just kind of an ugly dude. So that was fine by me. So why the Bible verse? You may be familiar with that story of Samson and Delilah. And Samson was a giant, much like Andre, with a huge mane of hair. And Andre had, you know, the locks of hair. And Samson, as the story goes, the source of his strength, which Delilah was trying to get from him on behalf of the Philistines, because they were trying to weaken Samson in some way, before he finally revealed that it was his hair that gave him strength. And you take Andre's haircut here in late 1984 and combine it with the physical deterioration from, like, the disease that he was suffering from, there's a lot of similarities, I think, between the story of Samson and Delilah and Andre the Giant's decline. I mean, unless you consider the fact that Andre was pretty damn good in 1988. If you listen to the Place to Be podcast, they've been loving what Andre has been doing in mostly a ringside role, so you take it from the perspective of his in-ring work. He really could not move anymore, and yeah, you could probably draw it back to his 1981 ankle injury and start from there. But honestly, I think it's around 1984 where you start to see the decline of the Giant. In fact, I'd say the last great sort of in-ring match that he had, and it's on the network, and I recommend this house show highly because it has a British Bulldogs squash, even though they're not called the Bulldogs, it's Davey Boy and Dynamite, that has a Kamala Andre cage match from Maple Leaf Gardens from October of 1984, and that one is great fun, and Andre actually comes off the top rope with the seated splash for the finish. That's not something you'd be seeing him do after the haircut, because his physical abilities had pretty much left him. And Samson, captured by the Philistines, they gouge out his eyes and basically put him to work as a slave. Thinking, you know, how Andre is now sort of a slave to the WWF, because before 1984, he used to go out to various territories and kind of help out the local babyface against whatever heels were causing trouble. As for this angle, this scared me as a kid, because I looked at it like, if this could happen to Andre the Giant, this could happen to anybody. And in fact, they tried to pull the same thing, Patera and Stud, to try and cut Hulk Hogan's hair. File that under, like, the Department of Uselessness, cutting Hulk Hogan's hair. You wouldn't even have enough to store it in the freaking baggie. And how that played out was that Hillbilly Jim, who they'd been showing on TV for like over 2 months in the crowd, hopped the guardrail. Yeah, they did one of those angles, which can always be a little bit risky, and saved Hogan. And Hogan and Hillbilly Jim become good pals. He gives him the boots, and they do all that skit. But back to Andre, just seeing him in that vulnerable position, not something you'd see very often, and I just kind of thought to myself, wow, this is really spooky stuff. Having been brought up on the WWF alone, and having not seen Southern Wrestling, when I see this on Coliseum Video for the first time when I'm 9 years old, the hair was totally his strength, I think. And the Heenan family is sort of a, you know, stand-in for the Philistines. I don't know who exactly would play Delilah, who I might be referred to as a prostitute in the Bible. Sources kind of vary on that. So I'm not going to assign that to my man SD Jones, because he hit his head on the outside, and those things happen. So I'm going to assign that to Alberto Roman, who completely sucked in this angle, and he was just terrible. But as the nice little coda to this angle, and at least the airing of this on TBS, which you don't get on Championship Wrestling, you don't get on TNT, you don't get on Maple Leaf Wrestling. When they go to commercial, there's a little picture of SD Jones in the box in the middle of the screen that says World Championship Wrestling at the top, and right below it, it says, "This is not a good way to start the new year." It kind of looks like SD Jones is laid out drunk. I mean, poor SD. I'm just glad that they later gave him an LJN figure to kind of make up for the fact that they really kind of made him look bad. They done him wrong here. And as for Andre, like Samson, he would grow his hair out again, but not in a wrestling context, only for the movie The Princess Bride, playing Fezzik the Giant. And even then, he did a clean job to Wesley in that area with the rocks and all that. It seemed kind of preposterous given the size difference between the two of them. But as I've said in the past, sometimes Hollywood would not do a good job of booking Andre, and they would not protect him to keep him strong for future movies and appearances.
You know, one of the best things about being an ex-big leaguer is getting freebies to the game. Call the front office, bingo. And once these fans recognize me, I probably won't even have to pay for my light beer from Miller.
Down the clock!
I love them. These fans know I drink light because it's less filling and it tastes great.
Good seats, huh? You're in the wrong shape, buddy. Come on.
Oh, I must be in the front row.
Come on, come on.
Light beer from Miller. Everything you always wanted in a beer and less.
Good seats, hey, buddy? He missed the tag! He missed the tag!
The icon, Bob Uecker, for Miller Lite. Those ads back in the 80s were all so great. In fact, there's a statue of Bob Uecker up in the last row of the upper level at Miller Park in Milwaukee. I got my picture taken up there with my friends when we went to Miller Park in 2014. Somebody yelling down in front reminds me of one of the all-time great stories at a Bruins game. Unfortunately, this is one that I was not there for, but it's still spoken of with great reverence, because there was a guy who always used to complain about people who were standing up, and he would always yell, "Down in front, down in front." Eventually, he was dubbed the King of All Down in Fronters, you know, kind of like the Howard Stern King of All Blacks and all that. Well, eventually, one time, he got a little fed up with one person and actually shoved him down the stairs. And we never saw the King of All Down in Fronters again for 12 years when he made a random one-off appearance at a game a couple of years ago. There's also an ad for a documentary film, Snowstorm in the Jungle, that'll be airing on TBS. I don't know what you think it might be about, but it's about cocaine. So from that perspective, it makes sense to be appearing on a 1985 WWF show. Coming up next, we have the former Intercontinental Champion Tito Santana taking on No Class Bobby Bass, a staple of Canadian promotions throughout the 70s and into the 80s as well. In fact, looking at his WWF record for 1984, he worked exclusively in Canada on the Canada tapings for All-Star, as well as a few shots at Maple Leaf Gardens, including that match against the British Bulldogs alongside Goldie Rogers from October of 84. And he did one match in the United States, which was in Buffalo, New York, so just barely over the border. Tito, for his part, of course, always billed from Tukula, Mexico, which I was very sad to find out is not a real place. I always imagined it as kind of a Pacific beach town for whatever reason. I don't know why that was. I think it was because I think of Toluca Lake, California, and I kind of crossed it that way. Toluca, Mexico is a real place. So you transpose the C and the L. It is west of Mexico City, about 45 minutes to an hour west, with a population 820,000. It is the capital of the state of Mexico. That's a little confusing that there's a state named Mexico in Mexico. It's a major center of industry, and it is 8,500 feet above sea level, which is great for golf because your tee shots will go a hell of a lot further. I don't know how many golf courses there would be, but beware of drinking too much at altitude because it can do some weird things to you. Not that I would know anything about that. And Tito is back from injury after losing the Intercontinental title in October, taped in September. As we start out, Bass is mouthing off to the crowd because he has no class, and he's just living up to the gimmick entirely. Doesn't break clean, but Tito actually blocks the right hand, and he runs the ropes, and Tito drops down, and Bass, I can only describe this as an extremely peculiar move, just stops and just sort of stands there, and Tito hits a drop kick on him. As Bass begs off, Mosca reminds us about the deal with timeouts in wrestling.
Begging for time. There's no timeouts here, Jack. This is not the NFL, CFL, USFL. There's no timeouts.
On an earlier Greetings from Allentown, there was a reference to the USFL, and I wondered if it was the only time on a wrestling show that it was ever mentioned, but apparently not, because he mentions it third, behind the CFL, which is understandable considering, as I said, Mosca is one of the greatest players in the history of the CFL. Slap on an arm bar, Tito does. I don't find Bass to be particularly interesting, you know, as an enhancement talent. I guess he doesn't have to be. And then I notice that his tights on the back of it actually say "A Hard Day's Night," which I found kind of funny. Is he some sort of Beatles fan? But then I noticed even further that the Y in "A Hard Day's Night" is actually missing. So it's "A Hard Dass Night." Right? Apparently he needed to go to that letter store where you got all the t-shirts lettered and all that. Slam try, but Tito actually rolls through to maintain the hold, but Bass then fires up with a slam and then comes off the second rope and goes to work on Tito's knees. So some actual psychology being done in this match, which was kind of surprising. Now, you may recall, I've mentioned in the past, Angelo Mosca, originally from Waltham, Massachusetts, which is just northwest of Boston, maybe about 8 miles northwest of the city. And yeah, he played in the CFL a very long time, and he probably hadn't lived in Massachusetts in quite some time, but that accent somehow would still come out from him.
That's a smart, smart wrestler.
Sounds like me after about 4 bourbons watching wrestling and trying to analyze it as well. Now, Tito had been on TV since he lost the Intercontinental title, apparently. This is not like his return or anything. In fact, he appeared on Championship Wrestling on December 1st, December 8th, December 15th. He's on almost every single week. I don't know when he started using the figure four as his finisher to kind of stick it to Greg Valentine, stealing his finishing hold, but Mosca pretty much loses it at the sight of Tito doing that very thing.
What's he doing?
Looks like
this is a figure four, Jack. This is the hold that Greg Valentine uses. And Tito has studied the film of Greg Valentine, I know it. And he wants to feed Valentine some of that medicine for how he hurt his leg. I've never seen Tito use it before.
Now, who knows? Maybe he hadn't used it on the Canada tapings or whatever, and Mosca really hadn't seen him use it. But consider that feud an all-timer for perspective on Valentine and Tito. We're actually going to see Valentine a little bit later, so I'll kind of save my thoughts on him. But you watch Tito Santana from 1983 through 1986, where he's a really pushed singles wrestler at that intercontinental level. And you can't help but think that maybe he was underutilized later on after the breakup of Strikeforce. He had that great match with Mr. Perfect at the finals of the IC title tournament. Actually, I might be thinking of the match from Saturday Night's Main Event from July of 1990, that being the really good match, but he also was in the finals of that IC title tournament. Because he was always a guy that was liked and respected by the fans. And the El Matador thing, not sure that was entirely necessary because his gimmick could have just been good, likable, professional wrestler who happens to be from Mexico. I mean, that might have been enough.
On tour with the World Wrestling Federation, Friday, January 11th. Great action, the Omni in Atlanta, 8:15.
Here's another symbol of maybe the WWF's invasion of the South not being all peaches and cream. This Omni show from January 11th. Which drew 1,500 people to the Omni in Atlanta. 16,522 was the capacity for basketball at that time. So think about it being similar for wrestling and very low percentage, less than 10% of the building full for this card. And tell me if this is something that you would want to go see. I mean, they were certainly trying to appeal to the local fan base, especially with the opening match. Mr. Wrestling 2 defeated Terry Gibbs. Barry Windham defeated Moondog Rex. Mike Rotundo defeated Rene Goulet. Nikolai Volkoff defeated SD Jones. Blackjack Mulligan defeated the Iron Sheik in a Texas death match. Well, at least it's all clean finishes so far. Tito Santana defeated Intercontinental Champion Greg Valentine via disqualification. And in your main event, Big John Studd and Ken Patera defeated Andre the Giant and the Junkyard Dog via disqualification. So apparently, Andre did not have racial issues because of SD Jones, because there he is. He's teaming with JYD. There's a commercial break and an ad for Time Magazine, which I have not subscribed to in a very long time, like most people. Although, I saved almost every single issue of Time Magazine that I ever got in the 90s. So if you're looking for an issue from 92 through 99, I probably have it somewhere and I could search through it. Yet, I didn't save one freaking wrestling magazine between 88 and 91. Apparently, those are all gone, but I could find any freaking Time Magazine. That kind of sucks.
As Rafael just told me here at TBS, Feliz Año Nuevo. That's Happy New Year in Spanish. I hope I said that correctly. I didn't say it as rapidly as he, but the point was we mean it as much.
I'm glad things have progressed to the point where we don't have to be awkward about the Spanish language anymore because it's, you know, really a part of the culture now. I don't know why Freddie had to make it so weird, especially since we have the champ here now in a very rare appearance on television, Hulk Hogan, taking on Terry Gibbs, of all people. You'd think you bring in Hogan, you might have him against a name guy, but I guess Terry Gibbs would be kind of at the top of that jobber level. Around the same time on Championship Wrestling, Hogan also had a match against Johnny Rods, which is an OVP podcast dream match, but Gibbs and Rods kind of on the same level. Now, Hogan, I don't really get to talk about him as much in his early on days because he doesn't make that many appearances on television. He's referred to in like update segments and stuff, but you don't see him in a lot of matches. I'm going to run down the list a little bit later. Because in 84, he doesn't have a program. He's kind of doing that fighting champion thing that Bret Hart did in 92, facing a wide range of opponents. Orndorff, you get Piper later in the year, John Studd, mass superstar very early on before he leaves. So why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just throw him in with, you know, say the Iron Sheik? Well, the Iron Sheik was transferred over to Sergeant Slaughter, and they had that great series of matches, the boot camp match and all that. I think it's pretty hard to argue with the way they handled Hogan in 84. You want to establish him to your audience first as kind of that fighting champion that I was referring to. It might owe a little bit to Japan commitments in New Japan, because Hogan spent a lot of time over there since WWF still had that working agreement with New Japan all the way to mid-85, and then Hogan stops going over there and is exclusively in the WWF. Here, he is actually wearing the blue with the white knee pads in the Hulk Hogan alternate uniform system, and Eye of the Tiger still very much his theme, and in the video that I have, he comes out to that song and is not dubbed or anything like that, which is really nice. He puts on a headlock, and you know Hulk Hogan, he's like Lou Thesz. He's known for working headlock spots, and it kind of goes on for a bit, and that is to allow Johnny V, manager of Brutus Beefcake, and Brute Eye also alongside him, just stroll down to the ring to check things out and look around, which was the style at the time. You know, if Kamala was in action a couple months before this, Andre would come down and check things out. Just kind of a simple way of progressing things along. Know that these two guys have some sort of issue without doing an actual angle. And just think, 10 years later, this would be your Starcade main event. Those two guys. But they would actually engage in a house show run early in 85, Brutus and Hogan. This is right before Brutus started feuding with Hillbilly Jim, who, of course, was attached to Hogan by that point, and Hillbilly Jim ends up hurting his leg in an incident out in San Diego with Beefcake and Valiant. Hogan catches a foot early on and slugs Gibbs down, and Gibbs does not break clean on the ropes and actually hits Hogan over the referee, does that move. And then, very peculiar, that he hits a axe handle from the second rope and he lands three elbow drops on Hogan. It seems like an awful lot of offense for Terry Gibbs in a match against 1985 Hulk Hogan, granted taped in 84, but I mean, you know what I mean. But right after that, we get the Hulk up. You know the deal. It follows Gibbs into the corner. It's slightly different than the Hulk up you would see later on. It was that corner-to-corner whip where he would follow him in. And usually he would clothesline the guy, but here it's actually a back elbow. Slam and the leg drop finish things off. So no big boot. A little bit of variation there. And it's just really strange. I always talk about Ric Flair in squash matches, how it's a little strange seeing him in that environment. It's probably even more bizarre seeing Hogan, because when you see him on TV years later, his opponents would be like Bob Orton in May of 87, Boris Zukov in May of 88, kind of these one-off things against known commodities who aren't pure jobbers. And like I said, I guess Terry Gibbs, not a pure jobber, because I think he was, you know, presented as slightly a cut above that. But to see Hogan against a regular sort of enhancement talent is kind of strange. He does follow up with the express pose. We don't get the full bit like you would on later pay-per-view. So here's Hogan's TV history, dating to his victory over the Iron Sheik on January 23rd, which did air on the following weekend's TV on January 28th, both on Championship Wrestling and on All-Star. His first match after winning the title is against AFA on the April 14th episode of All-Star Wrestling. So, very strange. You would never see Hulk Hogan in a match on Wrestling Challenge. It would be something that would be originally on Superstars, and they want to show it on Challenge to kind of drive home the point. The next week, April 21st, faced Tiger Chung Lee. And then he had a match on the June 30th edition of Maple Leaf Wrestling, where he defeated Rene Goulet. That's another bizarre match that I'd love to check out sometime. And then another match on Maple Leaf Wrestling on September 15th. I think I may have that episode somewhere in my strategic reserve, where he defeats Moondog Rex. It's just, you know, Hogan, kind of like everybody else, where he's out there, he's going to work his enhancement match. It's just you wouldn't see him that often. And this is the first time you see him in a match, obviously, on the TBS show. And I wonder if maybe he should have been utilized to a greater extent to try and win over that Southern audience, because he had experience down there working in Southeastern and, of course, in Florida and all that. I'm not sure it would have gone particularly well, and maybe that's the reason why they didn't want to take that chance. They didn't want to put Hogan in a situation where it was only 50-50 at best that he would actually succeed and win over that crowd.
Pendleton into left center field. That ball is down, and a bad ball. It's off the wall. Lonnie Smith is held up at third, and he didn't do very good base running. That was terrible by Lonnie.
He didn't pick the ball up. He stopped when he rounded second base. He may have gone for the decoy around second.
That play from Game 7 of the 1991 World Series makes me mad on several different levels. The fact that it cost the Braves the game because it was 0-0 going to the 10th inning and Smith should have scored on the play but fell for the fake by Chuck Knobloch. Minnesota wins the World Series when they weren't even a good team. The 87 Twins and the 91 Twins, two of the worst World Series champions of all time. And because Lonnie Smith was a bad base runner, we're now suffering Jack Morris in the friggin' Baseball Hall of Fame. Jack freaking Morris, he of career ERA 6% better than the league average over the course of his career. Yeah, that's a real Hall of Famer. So if Lonnie Smith actually runs the bases correctly, Jack Morris isn't in the Hall of Fame. Same Hall of Fame that Roger Clemens can't get in, but Jack Morris somehow is in the freaking Hall of Fame. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. It really annoys the hell out of me. It's also an ad for Bud Light, which is their Gimme a Light series, and then the guy would throw a lamp down the thing and say, no, no, Bud Light, ha, ha, ha. You know, Bud Light, clearly inferior product to Miller Lite. I mean, you got Bob Uecker, you know, selling Miller Lite in that commercial, and on Bud Light, you got lamps selling it. I went to a bachelor party in Maine in 2010, and all of us were, you know, commissioned to bring beer. And most of us brought Bud Light. And I'm ashamed to say that I did as well, because I developed my taste buds for Miller Lite shortly after that point, because everybody brought Bud Light except for my friend Merrill, who bought a 20-pack or 30-pack of original Coors that was treated like this sacred thing because it was not Bud Light. And everybody was entirely sick of it. Publisher's Clearinghouse ad is what I thought was going to be up next, but it was actually an Ed McMahon for some life insurance thing. I wasn't particularly interested in that. And then another ad for Threads. For our next match, we have the Moondogs. I don't really remember them making an impact in 84 and 85 WWF, and they are taking on Jim Powers and Muhammad Saad. I remember Muhammad Saad from an episode of The Titans of Wrestling, which I mentioned earlier, but I remember Saad getting really indignant towards the crowd, apparently, because they booed him before some match against Sergeant Slaughter or something like that. And also, I recall Johnny mentioning that he had this head of hair that had to be seen to be believed, and he still got a very good fro/perm going on at this time. Jimmy Powers, still a few years away from Young Stallions fame alongside Paul Roma. Moondogs, obviously, much better in Memphis, but in WWF, they were still very good back in 1981, at least before Moondog King got ratted out at the border for some sort of violation of some kind, so then he has to be replaced, and they kind of go downhill from there, lose tag titles back to Gurria and Martel in due time. Mosca does point out that they were the tag team champions at one time, which he probably got in trouble for, because by 1985 WWF, you're not mentioning 1981 anymore, that sort of denial of history. That would sort of bug me. There's certainly going to be no mention of somebody like Bob Backlund, and he held the title and carried the company from 78 to 83, because he ain't there, and he's talking shit about WWF over on Pro Wrestling USA and carrying cardboard belts and stuff like that. Crossbody by Powers, but he is caught by Moondog Rex, and he's tossed into the corner, not like a Rollins buckle bomb. This one is actually kind of way more safely done, which, you know, because it's not Seth Rollins, that goes without saying. They work over Powers for a bit. They go for a pin, but they actually pull up Powers. Very subtle, though. He didn't do the yank of the head up. shoulder breaker, and then he does it again with a little bit more emphasis, almost like, I got to repeat this spot to really drive home the point. And Saad is reaching for the tag. He hasn't even gotten into the match yet. And referee does not see the tag. They do that bit where the babyfaces make the tag, but the referee didn't see it. Kind of an odd match to be doing that. A lot of weird stuff on this show with Hogan in the enhancement match and... we're going to do the referee didn't see the tag spot with Muhammad Saad of all people. And then there's a Beal to the corner, and that is how Powers actually finally gets the tag. It's really strange because then he threw him over the corner on purpose anyway, so the whole thing was kind of invalidated. And here is Saad, and he immediately gets power slam. And the finish that the Moondogs were using at this time is particularly interesting given the history of one of these men, in particular Randy Colley, Moondog Rex. They used the demolition decapitation, which is slightly, the only difference between the two is when demolition would do it, Axe would kind of come off and he would tilt his body like so to deliver it. This one was a little bit more straight on, kind of like what the Hart Foundation would do. But of course, Moondog Rex would be the original smash in demolition for only a couple of matches before he got switched out. It's just so fascinating to see them doing that move as their finisher, given the fate of one of those guys. John Fogerty's old man down the road actually broke into the top 100 on that week in 1985, and that was the song that Fantasy Records took him to court over plagiarizing himself, that infamous case where they accused him in that song of plagiarizing Run Through the Jungle by CCR, but because Fantasy Records owned the CCR catalog, they said, well, you're not allowed to use that particular riff. And it led to a situation where in court, he's demonstrating the chords and everything. A really absurd situation that I've read about in the CCR book that I read a long time ago. We have a promo now from Tito Santana. And they say that between him and Valentine, there is no love lost. And I thought to myself, all right, what is the origins of that phrase, no love lost? And it goes back to the 16th century, and it is what it sounds like. It is basically two people who hate each other greatly, so there would be no love lost in that situation. However, the original meaning of it also had an alternative, which was that two people who love each other equally, and that there would be no love lost in that. So that was something that got dropped later on. Tito, with a satin robe that has a sombrero on the lapel, I don't know why he didn't bust that out on a more regular basis.
You know, he calls himself the warrior. You know what I call you? I call you a track man. Because the last time we were there 2 months ago, he set a record from the ring to the dressing room, Gene. I had the man beat. I gave him 12 scars, and he doesn't understand where I'm coming from. I had 6 weeks to think about it, Greg Valentine, with my leg up in the air, not knowing what I was going to do for my family, how I was going to bring their groceries in.
Jeez, if he needed somebody to bring in the groceries, he should have looked to that woman who played Rosalita in The Goonies, since she was doing that in that very movie. And he also wouldn't have had to rely on Corey Feldman to translate stuff, because Tito speaks Spanish.
This is my supply closet. You'll find everything you need. Brooms, dustpans, insect spray. I would really like the house clean when they tear it down. Clark, can you translate?
Si no hace buen trabajo. Será encerrada aquí con las cucarachas por 2 semanas sin agua y sin comida.
Okay, Rosie? Okay? You're going to be very happy here. Come on, Clark, we've got much more to do. You're so fluent in language.
Es una casa de locos, por Dios.
Lupe Ontiveros actually got nominated for an Emmy for her role on Desperate Housewives back in 2004-2005. She didn't win, but it's kind of funny that, like, oh, that woman who had that weird role in The Goonies because they wrote the mother's broken arm into the story. It, really one of the bizarre things, but I always love that line of, I really want the house clean before they tear it down. Do another plug for the Omni show to try and sell it with the specific matches, looking at the Sheik Mulligan death match. Hopefully that goes a little better than a David Arquette death match. What a complete
shit show that was. I mean, what a complete idiot to go put himself, oh, what, because you won the WCW title in 2000? Like, oh, I feel obligated to go back into wrestling and to risk myself doing stupid stuff like that. It's just, oh, God, facepalm inducing on that one. Up next, we have Ronnie Hutchinson taking on the Intercontinental Champion Greg Valentine. And the first thing that I notice is Valentine, a man who had so many managers in his WWF stints. Grand Wizard back in 81, Albano when he came back in 84, which always seemed kind of an odd pairing. They were together when Valentine won the IC title. No manager at this point. Then he goes on to Jimmy Hart, who was there by WrestleMania 1. Then somehow ends up with Johnny Valiant as part of the Dream Team, and then ends up back with Jimmy Hart in 1987 after Valiant leaves before the split with Jimmy Hart, which would not come till late 90, early 91. So kind of a rare look at him. He's a guy that, yeah, he probably best paired with a manager. They had the right idea, and certainly best as a heel. But there's really nobody to pair him with at this point because Lou Albano had just had his babyface turn at the end of 84. So it's kind of a quiet separation. I don't recall ever hearing about or seeing an angle. I think Valentine said something like Albano went soft or something like that. I don't think you could really put him with Blassie because that pairing doesn't make a lot of sense at this point in time. And Jimmy Hart is not there until March 1st. Heenan, I think Heenan was busy with other stuff, so you didn't really want to give him a guy. And also, it would have ruined the Heenan has never managed a champion thing if he had managed Valentine when he was the IC title holder. This Ronnie Hutchinson guy, actually, is a trainer with quite a bit of history. He trained Christian, Edge, Trish Stratus, Gail Kim, so a lot of big names on his resume, but he also trained Tiger Ali Singh as well, which may cancel out the four names that I just read. He's also the trainer for something called the Naked Women's Wrestling League, which had Carmen Electra attached to that, and obviously that kind of went away fairly quickly. That was in the 21st century. Valentine is very annoyed, per Jack Reynolds on commentary. I gotta say, that's kind of a perpetual look for Greg Valentine, forever with that sneer on his face. That's why when they made him do the black hair and do the whole Roy Orbison cosplay in Rhythm and Blues, he'd always kind of look at the camera and do that thing with his mouth, because that's what Greg Valentine does. He's sort of a natural heel. Thinking about him as a babyface in 91 is just a little bit weird. He's a guy, I think, and I was thinking about his whole career dating to the early 70s, where his first match in his career was actually against Angelo Mosca, oddly enough, and then all the way to the late 80s before he pretty much faded out from there. He had a U.S. tag title run in WCW in 92, but really kind of much ado about nothing. He was a guy, I think, that was perfectly suited to the era in which he worked. And I say that because of my love of time-traveling wrestlers, where Paul Orndorff, I want to take him from place to place and have him work in different eras and territories, stuff like that. Have even a guy like Cesaro, I'd like to take back to the 70s and see how you do as sort of the foreign menace heel, working a program with Bruno. I think that would really be great. Valentine just strikes me as a guy who was a perfect wrestler for the 1970s, and then he was still very good all the way through the 1980s, up to the end of the Ronnie Garvin feud at the 1990 Royal Rumble. When he has to dye his hair black and goes into Rhythm and Blues, I think things certainly fall off from there. He dumps Hutchinson outside the ring, and Jack Reynolds gets a little confused here because he calls that Valentine's patented move.
There's one of Valentine's patented moves right there, throwing his opponent out of the ring.
I don't know what the hell he's talking about. If you applied at the patent office to patent that move of simply throwing a man outside the ring, I think it would be rejected out of hand. I think the closest anybody came to trademarking that particular move would be the Berserker in 1991. And even then, he only got close because I think The trademark office got a little confused by the fact that he applied earlier as the Viking, and then he went in as this new persona, the Berserker, and that's how things kind of got crossed up. But once back inside, this turns back into a normal match, trust me on this. And Valentine, the double underhook snap suplex, not something I would see from him very much. He would often do that vertical where he would sort of throw the guy, like sort of like almost like a sidearm thing that he would do, and then drops a couple of those hammer elbows, and the figure four, of course, finishes this match. There are two of them on this show because you had Tito earlier on, but Mosca does not freak out for Valentine's figure four. Just an easy win for the Intercontinental Champion, and they go back to Freddie Miller, who wraps it up quickly saying that you should tune in tomorrow for the Sunday show of the WWF on TBS, which is so rare. I don't know if I've ever seen a copy of it, although maybe it's that I'm not thinking of the exact dates. You know, because you have a Saturday show and a Sunday show, and which day is Saturday, which day is Sunday. The Sunday show would air at 7:05 p.m. Eastern Time, and this was actually going to be a best-of show that they were doing. There is a best-of show that is out there from November of 84. I'm not entirely sure what is on that one. And there it is. That's a wrap on WWF on TBS for January 5th, 1985. This show, I think, had a little bit more to it than some of the other TBS shows, because you got the IC champ, his top contender, world champ in action. You get the big angle with Andre, Stud, and Patera, all kind of top or top-ish sort of guys. So a little bit better than your average TBS show.
Because of the HIV virus that I have attained, I will have to retire from the Lakers today. I just want to make clear, first of all, that I do not have the AIDS disease, because I know a lot of you want to know that, but HIV virus. My wife is fine. She's negative, so no problem with her. I plan on going on living for a long time, bugging you guys like I've always have.
I will never forget that day as long as I live, because I came home from school, and my sister, the same one that I cut the hair of her Barbie doll that I referred to a couple of episodes ago, told me that, quote, Magic Jordan has AIDS. Those were her exact words. And I thought to myself, all right, this is pretty big, but I don't know if she means Magic Johnson or Michael Jordan. So I said, which one? And they're like, oh, Magic Johnson. So, okay. And immediately I thought, oh my God, he's going to die. Because of HIV and AIDS, the rate of death, you've seen it with Freddie Mercury shortly before that. I think he had died earlier in 1991, Rock Hudson in the 80s. And I thought, well, Magic's going to be dead by like 1999. It's like 7 or 8 years. It was basically a death sentence. Of course, we all know now that the research, it allowed people to prolong their life. And Magic, of course, still very much with us as an owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And when I think about it, though, and he actually came back to play on the Dream Team in 92, which I'm certain is going to be one of the sports moments for the next episode, and in the All-Star Game in 96, making a comeback, even having that bizarre coaching stint with the Lakers in 94, where they won 4 straight games, and then I think they lost 11 out of 12 to wrap up the season. But when Magic was the best and worst thing that happened for AIDS, HIV awareness in this country. It was a good thing because you had this huge name that everybody knew to bring awareness to the subject. However, on the flip side, he had basically sort of, quote, conquered the disease after a while. I mean, as I said, he is still with us 27 years later. This took place November of 1991. And people kind of thought, well, problem solved, because Magic beat it. Why can't anyone else? Well, not everybody had the same means as Magic Johnson. Also, he's a very trained professional athlete. So he was kind of one step ahead. When you're in really good shape, it's a lot easier to fight disease with all the medications and stuff like that. So from that perspective, I think a lot of people started to tune out the problem presented by AIDS and HIV in this country as part of it. So it's kind of a catch-22 on that one. No YouTube comment theater this week, although before I go into my podcast plugs, I do want to thank Richard Land for his technical assistance on this episode. If there was a closing credit sequence, which you know how much I love those, especially if you're going to show the big angle, like can't they show Andre's hair getting cut or something as they roll credits? WWF, of course, never rolled credits. I would have Richard in there for like special thanks to Richard Land or something like that. And of course, special thanks to Keith Langston for reading Judges 16 for me, so I didn't have to. Yeah, on the Our Vantage Point podcast, they talk about this weird off-spec show from, I don't even want to call it an indie show, from July of 1999. It was really kind of strange description of what was going on, and it followed up earlier in the show where they're talking about odd shows and the major promotions, kind of like how the wrestling classic from 1985 stands out as kind of really odd and different than other WWF shows of the time. On the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Brian Malonis down in Mickey Mouse Land this past week, a variety of guests filling in for him, including Chaotic Wrestling owner Brian Fury, explaining why he returned to the ring after retiring 2 years ago, which I have no problem with. You know why? Because if Terry Funk can break 12 retirements, surely Brian Fury can break one retirement. And on the Sportscasters with my Adams Vision podcast partner, Steve Bennett, be on the lookout for the Adams Vision podcast dropping later today, I believe, is when that Survivor Series pod, it figures that it should drop on Thanksgiving Day, as is tradition, as when the Survivor Series started. On the most recent episode, he has John Feinstein, one of the great sports authors of all time. Stuff like Season on the Brink, Good Walk Spoiled, books that I remember. He wrote a book with Red Auerbach, I believe, right before Red passed away about 12 years ago. I remember reading that when I was out in Las Vegas on one of my trips out there. And also a book on the Rudy Tomjanovich Kermit Washington punch called The Punch, from 1977, which was an incident that happened. It was all Kareem's fault. He basically instigated the whole thing that led to Rudy T getting his face broken by Kermit Washington, who basically threw a punch and hit Rudy T, who was coming right at him, and all the stuff surrounding that, the suspension of Kermit Washington, that was a book, I think it's 15 years ago. I ended up getting the galley copy of it. That would be the free copy that came into Barnes & Noble. I would often hoard any John Feinstein book that would come in through there, because I was the receiving manager, and I would see it first, so I would just grab that, and I wouldn't share it with any other people, so do check that out. As for next week's show, I have a number of things on the list. Stay tuned to Facebook and Twitter on that. I think I'll have a reveal on that a little bit earlier than I usually put up the teaser on Tuesday. This week, I didn't get around to it on Wednesday. My schedule is a little delayed because of the power outage at the beginning of the show, which the power was out then, and I taped the rest of the segments after about the 30-minute mark later on, and this show is actually getting finished a lot later than usual. As I speak right now, it is Wednesday afternoon at 4 p.m., and I am not working because in my contract position, I got furloughed for 5 days. Now, fortunately, I had some degree of choice on which 5 days I could take, and because the manager likes my work, he actually gave me the day before and day after Thanksgiving off. So I'm giving thanks for that, even though I'm not getting paid for it. And my 2 days where I'll be going to the Winter Classic in Indiana, so December 31st and January 2nd, and then I took a day to do Christmas shopping at some point in December. So that was fortunate and allowed me to get this podcast finished in time. I'm thinking next week might be a WCW show simply because I haven't covered one in about 7 or 8 episodes, and I'd like to turn back to that at some point. I have a couple on the list. It also might be a Jim Crockett promotion show because I have one from 1987 that I've had queued up for quite some time. I want to make sure I get to it, although I did download it to the emergency reserve just in case, because you never know what might happen. Of course, all the stuff on the award-winning WWE Network. I may start pulling a little bit more stuff from there if I attempt to do another ECW show down the line, or World Class, although I don't want to infringe upon World Class territory on that, but we shall see. There's certainly a lot out there to cover and a lot that I would like to get to. My upcoming episodes for podcast playlist on YouTube is probably about 70 shows deep right now in the Strategic Reserve. There's about 50 more. So I got about 2 years of shows to work through. So not going anywhere, in the parlance of Ed McMahon as played by Phil Hartman on the great Carcinio sketch from Saturday Night Live. So enough blather from me. Thank you so much for listening, and please leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music, although it's come to my attention that most people do not listen to this show through Apple Music. But hey, if you can get in there somehow and give me a 5-star review, that'd be great. And do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
That's a smart wrestler.